Welcome to the Beltway Outsiders podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Vaughn. I'm a lawyer, columnist for the Conservative Institute, and a contributor in many places where I cover everything from politics, law, and culture. I send out a Friday newsletter each week full of political analysis and the best articles I've seen that week. You can sign up and get all of my columns, articles, and podcasts delivered right to your inbox each week by going to thebeltwayoutsiders.com and clicking on the sign-up link, or you can use the links in the show notes, which are available at any time by clicking on them for this or any episode. And finally, if you like what you hear here, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review. If you listen on the website, that's great, but it'd be better for the show if you went to iTunes, Google Play, Amazon Music, or wherever you're getting those podcasts and leave a review. Those five-star ratings help new listeners and readers like you find us, and I always look forward to reading them. And if you can't leave a review, sharing the podcast with others is usually how we grow anyway, so that is always deeply appreciated, and it is always good to see those numbers going up every week just due to word of mouth, and I'm thankful for each one of you who shares the podcast. For this week's show, on the first segment, we're going to talk about some of the latest bills and legislation and ideas on the antitrust front, where congressmen and we've got senators and representatives working on different ways to beef up antitrust law and to go after some of these big tech companies. I've written a lot about some of this, and we finally have some actual legislation to deal with that's been announced in the House, so I felt like this is a good time to go over some of those ideas. So we're going to go through five specific proposals in Congress and how they work, some of the broad concepts behind them, and some of my initial thoughts on hearing some of these. In the second segment, we'll do the COVID-19 numbers and all the updates there, all the good numbers and everything. And then the light item this week is a monologue by Bill Maher going after progressives for being blind to reality. So make sure to stay tuned for that. That is the agenda for this week's show, so we can jump right in. So like I said, I've written several times in the newsletter about how antitrust is the best avenue for channeling a lot of this populist energy that you see on the left and right at big tech companies. I really think using antitrust to some extent is the best option here, especially when you're comparing it to flexing out Section 230 or creating whole new regulations for some of these companies to follow. Ultimately, I think creating new regulations or changing Section 230 is just, those are the worst of the worst options available. And if anything is going to happen, because I don't believe the status quo is going to hold here, I just think antitrust is probably the best way to channel some of this energy, because I just don't see the status quo holding. So you've got to get some kind of answer through without it being some sort of bad legislation in the form of modifying Section 230. Or just creating whole cloth new regulations. So we want to avoid those types of things and channel this through antitrust. I've written out multiple times now in the newsletter and in some columns why I think antitrust is that. If you want to go read some of that, you can go back into the archives and check that out. So we're just going to proceed forward here and just presume here for the sake of this that antitrust is the best focus to make. So as I said at the top, there's some ideas that have finally been put forward by Democrats and Republicans in the House to help beef up antitrust regulations and basically to help antitrust be updated to go after big tech companies and some of the things we're seeing in the country today. So the House Committee on Antitrust held a press conference on Friday. Basically, this was the sum total of all the hearings and all of the reports that they've been reviewing, and they released what they called five bipartisan bills that provide a range of ideas, though they're designed to work together, on going after big tech in particular, and specifically the real big companies. So you're talking about Google, Amazon, Apple, those kinds of companies. That's who they're looking at here. That's who they're thinking about with these regulations. So that's why some of this is tailored pretty specifically. You're going after the top end of this market. You're not really concerned with the mid-tier, and you're not really concerned at all with the lower tier. So some of these things I do like. Other things I am more skeptical of and would like to see some of it fleshed out. But I really appreciate the push to provide ideas and legislation on this front and not just sort of hang back and wait for whoever has the last idea to be the one that gets pushed through the House and Senate. So it's good to see some initiative here by Congress to providing some answers This is why they exist, and it's just good to see it doing this, and it looks to be a good faith effort on everyone involved, because these are some well-thought-out ideas that are different some of other things that you've seen in popular media. So again, as I said, these do have bipartisan support. So when I'm going through some of these, you will see on each one they're listing a Republican and a Democrat that supports each one of these measures. That's sort of to signal these have bipartisan support. These have the broad support of most of the members of these committees. So they're trying to signal here that, yes, we have worked together. These are some of the ideas we would like to see the entire Congress move ahead on some of these ideas. So here's the pitch that the committee put out as part of their statement, as part of their press conference. This skips into some of the specific lines they're giving. So it says, quote, "The American people sent us to Washington to get things done. Nothing is more important than ensuring every American has an opportunity to get ahead," said Chairman Cicilline. "Right now, unregulated tech monopolies have too much power over our economy. They are in a unique position to pick winners and losers, destroy small businesses, raise prices on consumers, and put folks out of work. Our agenda will level the playing field and ensure the wealthiest, most powerful tech monopolies play by the same rules as the rest of us," end quote. The next quote is, "Big tech has abused its dominance in..." Oh, and by the way, that was the Democrat, the ranking member and chair of the committee. He runs the show. This next one is from Representative Ken Buck. He is the ranking minority member from the Republican side, so he is also chipping in here. And he says, "Big tech has abused its dominance in the marketplace to crush competitors, censor speech, and control how we see and understand the world. Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google have prioritized power over innovation and harmed American businesses and consumers in the process. These companies have maintained monopoly power in the online marketplace by using a variety of anti-competitive behaviors to stifle competition. This legislation breaks up big tech's monopoly power to control what Americans see and say online and fosters an online market that encourages innovation and provides American small businesses with a fair playing field. Doing nothing is not an option. We must act now." So I would emphasize that last part, because it's coming from a Republican, because he's saying what I've been saying here: doing nothing is not an option. You've got to act. And this is where I think civil libertarians have really missed the boat on this. They are only pushing back against taking any action at all, because if you don't want any of this kind of legislation to happen, as I've written, you have to get these companies to change their behavior. They've got to effectively revert to basically a 2015 world pre-Trump, at least on the political side, where people aren't having information controlled. It was controlled then, but the algorithms were not quite the way they were now. And the other thing that you're going to see as we get into some of these proposals, the actual competition in the actual economic marketplace is what some of these proposals are going after too, because you've had, you know, Amazon says they don't do this, but you have had instances where Amazon is specifically going out stealing ideas from people who are selling products on their website and then selling a cheaper version and is ripping off the people who sell on their marketplace. And they've got other issues. They've got issues with Chinese manufacturers ripping off people and then hijacking postings that have higher reviews. If you've shopped on Amazon at all, you've seen these things happen before. So a lot of this is going not just after the political speech side of this, but it's going after instances where people who are trying to make a living via these platforms, and that's the key phrase here. These are, if you're one of these companies and you're creating a platform and you make it uncompetitive through various means, that's what this legislation goes after. So it's not just about speech. It's about other things. And these are things that do need to be gone after, because some of these companies just have bad policies in place, and they can claim they have policies, but we have plenty of stories and evidence that they're not following any of it. So you've got to pop them on this front. So the press conference statement continues and says, "A stronger online economy, opportunity, innovation, and choice consists of five bipartisan bills drafted by lawmakers on the Antitrust Subcommittee, which last year completed a 16-month investigation into the state of competition in the digital marketplace and the unregulated power wielded by Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google." So you've got five bills really focusing on those five big companies. So here are the proposals that the House of that are going to be put for both the committees and the House and some of these also have similar versions in the Senate. So these are some of the main ideas that are going to be debated in the coming weeks, months, and potentially years here, depending on how all this goes down. So the first one is the American Innovation and Choice Online Act. It is going to prohibit discriminatory conduct by dominant platforms, including a ban on self-preferencing and picking winners and losers online. These are descriptions from the committee. We're going to go into some of the a little bit more about what these do on a specific basis, but this is just what the committee gave out in their thing. So this bill is sponsored by the chairman, Cicilline, and co-sponsored by U.S. Representative Lance Gooden out of Texas. The second one is the Platform Competition and Opportunity Act. It prohibits the acquisitions of competitive threats by dominant platforms, as well as acquisitions that expand or entrench the market power of online platforms. That one is sponsored by U.S. Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York and co-sponsored by Ranking Member Ken Buck. So you've got some big names attached to that one as well. Third, you've got the Ending Platform Monopolies Act. These all have funky names because it's Congress. Anyway, this one eliminates the ability of dominant platforms to leverage their control across multiple business lines to self-preference and disadvantage competitors in ways that undermine free and fair competition. That one is sponsored by Representative Pramila Jayapal out of Washington and co-sponsored by U.S. Representative Lance Gooden out of Texas. The fifth one is a little bit different, so this is the fourth act with a long name. This is called the Augmenting Compatibility and Competition by Enabling Service Switching, otherwise known as the Access Act, because it wouldn't be Congress if you didn't have a long acronym that made no sense at all. Anyway, it promotes competition online by lowering barriers to entry and switching costs for businesses and consumers through interoperability and data portability requirements. That one is sponsored by Mary Gay Scanlon of Pennsylvania and co-sponsored by U.S. Representative Burgess Owens of Utah. Again, we're going to go into all of these. This fifth one here is a little bit different. It is called the Merger Filing Fee Modernization Act, and it updates filing fees for mergers for the first time in two decades to ensure the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission have the resources they need to aggressively enforce antitrust laws. That one is sponsored by Representative Joe Neguse, I think is how you say his name, out of Colorado, and co-sponsored by U.S. Representative Victoria Sparks out of Indiana. So that's sort of the names and everything. We're going to go through these. I'm going to start in reverse because my favorite on this list is actually that last one. It is smaller, but it actually does some really good things. So the Merger Filing Fee Modernization Act would, according to the Wall Street Journal, raise filing fees for mergers valued more than $1 billion and lower them for transactions underneath $500,000, and it would generate an estimated $135 million for antitrust enforcement in its first year, and that's according to a summary. There's similar legislation in the Senate. So effectively what happens is that if you're going to go through a merger or an acquisition of this type, you have to file a filing fee to go through the process of going through antitrust review to make sure you're not violating anything along those lines. So what this does for these really big companies is it raises the fees for them to do that, and it raises the fees for them to do business along that front. It also lowers it for those that are under $500,000. So you're kind of cutting two ways here. You're getting money and basically taxing these big companies for doing large deals, and you're making it easier for some of the smaller companies to do their acquisitions and mergers and all that sort of thing. So it's sort of a way to lower the fee and lower the barriers of entry for the smaller companies while raising it for the larger ones. For the larger ones, it's not going to really matter what the fee is. They're going to pay it, so you're going to raise good money from them to do this. So again, the estimate is $135 million. That's always going to go to the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission and their lawyers when they're trying to enforce antitrust laws. It gives them more resources potentially to go after some of this. So it's basically a form of tax, just in the form of a fee on these big tech companies. So you're trying to get resources to the Department of Justice Division and the Federal Trade Commission while also making sure you're not overly burdensome with some of these smaller companies doing some of the same mergers and acquisitions activities. So I think this is a really smart way to, you know, give resources to the people who are doing some of this, and you're going after the companies that are actually taking these actions. And so this is potentially one of the better ideas I think they put forward, because it allows you to get that funding directly who needs it, and it's funding the process and everything. So I think this is probably the better one. It obviously doesn't do anything as far as like telling you which of these provisions are going to get enforced and all that, but it does get resources to these departments and gets resources to specifically the lawyers involved. So I think that is specifically a good thing, because when you're dealing with some of these, antitrust is going to be one of the smaller divisions you're dealing with here. It's obviously, it exists with the Department of Justice and FTC, but it's not the largest of all the others. So if you're getting them specific resources, anything you get them is going to be good. So that's probably just outright my most favorite one. Like, if you put that before me right now to vote on, I would very strongly consider voting for that one, because it's pretty straightforward, it's pretty simple, and it gets at least immediately something that does need to happen. So that's probably my favorite one. The rest of them have pluses and minuses of them. We're going to go through some of those. So the Wall Street Journal gave a breakdown of the Ending Platform Monopolies Act. And they said, the Ending Platform Monopolies Act seeks to require structural separation of Amazon and other big tech companies by breaking up their businesses. It would make it unlawful for a covered online platform, so think a marketplace on Amazon, to own a business that, quote, utilizes the covered platform for the sale or provision of products and services, or that sells services as a condition for access to the platform. So the platform company also could own businesses that create conflicts of interest, such as creating the incentive and ability of the platform to advantage its own products over its competitors. So in essence, it would prevent some of these big tech companies from selling products in marketplaces that they control. So think situations specifically like Amazon's marketplace. When Amazon places their own products above that of others. So you have like an Amazon Essentials project. If you search for something, like I did a few weeks ago, if you're searching for hangers and Amazon has their version of them, and then you also have all these other third-party sellers, Amazon can place their products above that, make sure it has good reviews, and that advantages their products. So that's sort of what that's getting to there. It's also talking a little bit more towards the platform, where if you're going to run this platform, you have to run it more neutrally. So that's what that act does. There's a second one here that kind of plays into that, and it's the American Choice and Innovation Online Act. And that would prevent tech companies from advantaging their own business over a competitor. So the chair said about that bill, it would prevent Amazon from manipulating their marketplaces to promote their own products. And it would also address concerns that Apple preferences its own services in its app store. So the first one is more about, you know, interacting with your own platform, with your own products. The third one is you actively promoting and preferring yours over others. If you're trying to set up something like a neutral platform, but you're still, you know, breaking down and hurting some of these others who, you know, you've essentially allowed on, that's what they're trying to get around here. They're trying to say, if you're setting this up, you have to run it neutrally. You can't advantage your own products and services, and you can't do these things that make it anti-competitive. Now, obviously, the rejoinder to all of this is, well, Amazon and Apple, they built these things, and they should be allowed to do that because it is theirs. The rejoinder, you know, when you're talking back to that is, well, these companies have created a near monopoly in these own unique markets. And so you've got all these other people here who rely on these platforms, you can't, if you're going to allow them to go on there, you should be a little bit more neutral. So there's really, it's coming down to this fight over what you can do with a platform that you build. Now, if you're just building something internally for yourself and you're not building a platform from others, well, that's a little bit different. So if Amazon just built its own thing, it's only selling its own products, well, you're not worried about anything like that. That's like, you know, going to, you know, a company that just makes its own products, and you don't have in there, you're not worried about anything else. So it's like going to, you know, the Post-it note company and buying all your Post-it notes from them. You don't have to allow third parties onto Post-it's website. This is about building a platform where others are involved, and allowing them all in there to sell, but then, you know, making it less competitive for them by jumping in, taking their products, and doing things like that. So the fight is over what constitutes this platform and what you're allowed to do with a platform where you're allowing everyone on board. So it's that's kind of these acts kind of they kind of these two in particular they intertwine quite a bit. Some there's a lot of overlap between the two of them. So it's not that Apple or Amazon couldn't have their own products or companies. It's just if they did, it would have to operate as a separate entity. So like take Amazon and Amazon Essentials. If they were going to run that platform, Amazon Essentials could not be run by Amazon. It would have to be a completely other company that they spun off into its own independent entity that then sold on that platform. So you couldn't be run under the same umbrella company. You would have to be a totally separate company, not owned by anything by Amazon, and run that way. That's how it would have to go down. There would have to be total separation there. So that's sort of what they're thinking here along these lines. You have total separation, and then you don't allow the promotion and things to go on. Because, I mean, Amazon and all its individual products, it sells well over 150,000 products. That's a ton. And so you're trying to make that a little bit more fair for other people. And if you go into a grocery store, the same thing happens there too. You have, you know, if you go into a Kroger and you see, you know, a can of green beans on the store shelf, you're going to see all the name brands, and then you're going to see the Kroger brand there as well. And you can choose to do whatever you want because Kroger knows the prices. They obviously price run underneath all those name brands. But, you know, that's how that goes. What they're looking to stop here is Amazon specifically stealing and undercutting information, because that's specifically what we know have happened. I know this community has seen information along those lines because some of that got repeated out, especially among a lot of the tech blogs. So again, those two pieces of legislation really work in tandem. And I think you have to sort of, all of these, of course, work in tandem together, but those in two particular, they're kind of lockstep together. I think you have to think about them in the same way. The third one here is the Platform Competition and Opportunity Act. This bill would prevent, quote, dominant platforms from acquiring companies that represent competitive threats. And members of Congress have previously questioned people like Mark Zuckerberg over Facebook's aggressive pursuit of competitors. And I'm more supportive of this one, because this is where you have Facebook buying somebody like Instagram and going in and eliminating a competitor. They made it a competing product. They made it their product, and they've linked them together, but that was a competitor to them. That was a competitor to Snapchat. Because before this, Facebook was really looking at a situation where they had nothing to offer in the forms of your Instagram and Snapchat and WhatsApp and TikTok crowd. They have nothing along the lines that can go with that. So they were very desperate to get something to survive here. And they bought Instagram. And I think Instagram basically saved them on this front because it made them a little bit more trendy on this line. But in any event, this would prevent things like that. Or at least in theory, it would prevent things like that. You have TikTok and Snapchat. Those have stayed independent from the main companies. TikTok is obviously a little different because there's all the connections to China, but Snapchat in particular is more independent from those companies. But you have had companies like Microsoft, I know Facebook and some of these others, they've all sniffed around those kinds of companies trying to buy them out to have that in their repertoire. So this would theoretically prevent that from happening and force these companies to stand up on their own. I'm more supportive of this one because that gets right into some of the meat of what's some of the issues here. It could also impact your Googles of the world. In fact, I think one of the main reasons that you had the full restructure of Google into Alphabet and then all these separate little entities was to make it easier in the end to split up some of these, where they could keep the search company under one roof while splitting off some of these others into their own individual entities. I think that's sort of the play there, at least long term. It makes sense to me in that way. I think you're going to see this is the main meat of it. The others are going into what happens when you have a platform. This is, you've got to stop these companies from buying up their competitors. So that's interesting happening there. More to come on that front. I think that's going to be the most hotly debated one, because it's the one where you're talking about beefing up actual antitrust laws to go after these specific companies. The fourth one is augmenting compatibility and competition by enabling Service Switching Act of 2021, otherwise known as the Access Act. Again, Congress loves its acronyms. But anyway, this bill is meant to make it easier to quit social media and take your data with you. The Wall Street Journal breakdown said the measure would force online platforms to make their services interoperable with those of competitors, which would mean different social networks must allow their users to communicate or allow e-commerce sellers to export their customer reviews from one site to another. So if you've got a big company on Amazon and you want to export all your reviews and everything to some other platform, you could do that, and it would be easier for you to do that, and you would have more ownership over that data. And again, like theoretically, I mean, this ownership of your data part is probably the most important thing. I don't know that this gets quite to it because it's not quite antitrust, but I would like to see more of an attempt by Congress to say that the data collected about you as a person can also be removed by you and you have more ownership of what these companies have on you. That would be nice to have because then you could have a little bit more control over who has it, or you could have information on who's leaked it, that sort of thing, especially with all this cybercrime and stuff. I think you have to give people more heads up and more control of their data long term. You just can't let this stuff be controlled by these companies. If it's about you, you should have more say here. That's not quite what the Access Act means, because it's talking about being able to switch services and things like that, which is important. So being able to port that back and forth is good. This also could be something that comes into play with movies and other media that you buy. It's like if you buy songs from the Apple Store, but you decide that you want to go to another music buying service, or you buy movies on Amazon and you're going to switch over to just using the Vudu service, or you're going to use your Roku or things like that, it allows you to switch all that data back and forth. So there's just one file. So you're not having to rebuy things. You're not locked into one platform. You have ownership of that specific thing. So in that front, I think, especially on the multimedia part, when you're talking about movies, music, and that sort of things, it is a little bit more important. With the rise of Spotify, I think on the music front, it's a little less important. But if you're still buying or burning or you know, keeping movies that way, it is obviously an important thing to you. And you know, if you're switching between streaming services, between Hulu, Netflix, if you bounce from them, it'd be nice if you just to port your preferences over to each one of these things so they just have that and you can have your new recommendations on the new services if you're just jumping around. So that's the sort of thing that we're sort of talking about here, just making it a little bit more flexible instead of keeping these all as individual silos. That is an interesting act by itself, just because it allows more interoperability between these two services. Roku is a service that was a very big proponent of this and some of the other things that allows more platform neutrality and allows them to use data and get data ported to them. They, you know, if you're just building a box like a Roku, that's obviously big for you. So some of these hardware companies that don't really care what it is, having, you know, being able to do some of that would make their lives a lot easier. So that is a, you know, that's a broad overview of the five major proposals. Again, I like the push to make it harder on the tech companies to buy competitors. And I think the fees, especially $135, $136 million, that could help fund some of these antitrust activities. Some of these others, I think, have some good ideas behind them, but I need to see some of it more fleshed out. I don't want to commit to any of them right yet. I think it's a little early on some of these platform things to know exactly how it could fall down. Some of these still have sections that need to be defined out just because it's Congress, and sometimes you allow some of these agencies to do some of the definitions. So I think we need to kind of get some ideas on how that could happen, how some of that could get fleshed out. But this is, I think, a very good opening set of ideas to figure out how to take on these tech companies and channel specifically the populist anger in this arena on both sides of the political aisle. Because I think if you're strengthening some of these things, it's going to channel some of that energy out and show that you're taking this issue seriously and show that you are doing good work. So I'm open to hearing other ideas and criticisms. So if you got some ideas or thought on this, you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'm curious to hear what you think about of it. I'm open to hearing new ideas. I'm open to criticisms of any of these. I think we're in that process now where it's good to start airing out ideas and grievances on this. I'm going to leave a link to in the show notes to the text of these bills. So if you want to go through and look at them some yourself, you can feel free to do that. But otherwise, I think it's a good time to sort of chat through and talk through some of these things. So I'm going to take a short break here, though. When we get back, we will go through the COVID-19 numbers. All right, for this week's COVID-19 update, we'll go through the numbers like normal, talk through a little bit through the variants, and then go from there. So testing rebounded a bit this week. We're still on the 750,000 to 800,000 range. We're below a million now. I think that's fine on a daily basis. We're in that 750,000 to 800,000 testing range. We're on the upper end right now. That'll probably continue to drift down over the coming weeks and months just because, again, testing is not that important anymore. The most important thing are your vaccines. Testing really just tells us kind of what's happening, and everything that's happening is good, so testing is just not in the, but that important right now. So the positivity rate on that testing continues to drop. We're officially below 2% this week, sitting at 1.8% on the positivity rate, which is the lowest percentage ever recorded on COVID-19. These are, of course, amazing numbers. This is not just because of testing lowering. This is because the spread of COVID-19 continues to slow in the United States. Nationally, the number of new cases coming in each day naturally is dropping also too, to all-time lows. Right now, we're sitting at 13,300 new, a little over 13,000 new cases a day, which is an all-time low. We're now below 15,000 and dropping. So these numbers, they're fantastic. Some of these are a little elevated right now, but that's only because of the holiday reporting lag. So it makes the averages just about across the board tick up just a little bit. But that is only because you had that delay where with Memorial Day weekend, all these states just kind of delayed. And sometimes they delay their cases, sometimes they delay their deaths. And so what it does is it'll cause these 1 or 2 day spikes in the numbers, which can make things in the 7 day averages elevated a little bit. But that's all started to sort of abate now and go away. So again, these are all-time lows. But I do think there's room for them to drop further just because we're going to get outside of all this holiday stuff, which can mess up the numbers, which has been true now for well over a year. So if you've been following me, you know I've noted multiple times when weather or holidays or other things has interacted with the COVID-19 numbers. And so that has caused some people to believe, oh, you know, after holidays, there's always these spikes. And that's not what's happening at all. What's happened is the data gets delayed, and then all of a sudden it all gets dumped in at once. That causes your rates and your averages to go up. That's all beginning to get behind us, though, because you're behind Memorial Day. But it will happen again on July 4th. So, you know, just be aware. If you start seeing people say, oh, the numbers are going up, and it's after July 4th, that could be true, but it is more likely than not that what you're seeing is, you know, somebody gets back into the office and like, okay, we've got about 3 or 4 days worth of data in here. We're just going to report it all at once and go from there because it doesn't really matter to them what's happening with the averages. So you just have to take into account that that's happening. Again, we're setting all-time new lows just about every day, so I'm not worried about any of these numbers. I just know, based on what I see other people talking about, that some people still, over this year and a half, they don't understand how to read this data. And when I hear people doubting the accuracy of the data, the thing I always point to are hospitalizations, because those are independent of any data reporting. If you're in a hospital, you're in a hospital, and they're going to report it, because they're staffed 24/7, and they're always reporting their information. So hospitalizations also continue to set all-time lows. Right now, active hospitalizations now sit below 15,000. The number of active hospitalizations right now is 14,350, so we've dropped below 15,000. Last week, we dropped below 20,000 for the first time. So we're really, really seeing a drop-off in the hospitalization numbers. There are some notes I'm going to make here at the very end about the people who are being hospitalized, but the actual numbers themselves are very, very good. The last ICU numbers I have are from Friday, and they show only 3,725 ICU cases with COVID-19 ICU cases nationwide. That is also an all-time low. 2 weeks before, those numbers were above 5,000, and if you remember back towards the peak, you were talking well over 10,000 people were in the ICU units nationwide, sometimes a lot more than that. So we are really falling off here. These are the worst of the worst cases. So the more you see that number drop, the better odds are we're going to see better results long term. And we're seeing that. So deaths are also dropping as well. We're averaging right now around 375 deaths a day. Obviously, far too much. You don't want that many people dying from this since we have vaccines now, but these numbers are continuing to drop. Again, I think with deaths, because there's so much of an inflation, there's so much of a delay in the reporting here, I think you're seeing more of the delay with deaths regarding the holidays here. I think you'll see that number drop here over the next couple weeks a little bit faster, just because hospitalizations and case numbers do not support the death rate plateauing at any form in any way, just because our numbers are continuing to collapse. So you would expect your death rate to eventually catch up to all of that. So this is all, of course, courtesy of vaccines, which continue going out for free across the country. We've administered nearly 310 million vaccination doses nationally. We've given one dose to 52.4% of the total population, just everyone, period. We've given one dose to 62% of those 12 and up, 12 years old of age and up. We've given one dose to 64.4% of those 18 years old and up. And so, you know, you're talking by next week, we're going to be north of 65% in that key category of the adult population. That is getting very close to hitting 70%. So, you know, about 5% away from hitting that 70%. That's very, very good. You're probably going to see us hit that here over the next 3 or 4 weeks, I would imagine, just based on current growth and where we're headed. The most important number here is the elderly population, and nearly 87% of those 65 and above are now vaccinated with one dose. 76.2% are fully vaccinated, so 3 in 4 of your elderly population are now fully vaccinated. You're approaching much higher numbers here with the one-dose category. It's almost, we're getting very, very close. It's probably going to take about 3 weeks to hit the 90% just because it's harder and harder to get that those people vaccinated because you're hitting those outliers that sit out there. It's not just a mass event. But it's not inconceivable that you could see 90% of the elderly population vaccinated, which would be amazing. That is herd immunity in that group straight up. If you want the full vaccination numbers, that's people who have completed a full two-dose regimen or have had a Johnson & Johnson vaccine, then 51% of the 12 years old and up crowd is now vaccinated, fully vaccinated. 54% of the 18 and above crowd is vaccinated. So, in short, we're basically above 50% in all key categories here in my mind. I think it's very clear that these numbers are pushing down the case numbers, the positivity rate, and all that. This isn't just, I've seen some people make the case, well, you know, these numbers are just dropping because of seasonality. You can't put this in front of the vaccines. And that's complete nonsense. This is not just seasonality. We had seasonality last summer. We never came close to hitting any of these numbers. As soon as we would bottom out in the 3 to 4% range on a positivity rate, we would immediately start trending back up because there would be a flare-up in one other side of the country or not. There is no more flare-ups. We are just hitting good numbers and metrics across the board. I mentioned variants. I've heard some people talking this week about the new Indian variant, both on Twitter and Facebook, where people are worried about this thing. It's gotten a new name. They're calling it the Delta variant. There's been a change in the naming conventions where they've used Alpha through Delta in naming some of these bigger variants here. I think changing the naming conventions, you know, 3/4 of the way through here at the very end is pretty stupid because people just don't understand that, and I think it sows more confusion. But the Delta variant and the Indian variant are the same thing, and in reality, there's only one thing's concerning, and that remains this Indian variant. Of all the variants, it's the only one that is growing in the data. So what they do is they sequence the types of infections that we're seeing, and that tells us which variants are showing up. So that's kind of how we know that the Indian variant is showing up in a lot of these places. Right now, it's more dominant in the United Kingdom than it is here in the United States, but it is still growing. But it should be noted that the Indian variant is growing while other variants are falling in percentage. So essentially, in my mind, what's happening here is that the Indian variant is filling in where these other variants are dropping off. So, you know, because when you look at the numbers, all the case numbers are dropping. That tells you that COVID-19 is receding nationwide. And if it's receding, but one variant is growing, then you have to find out what's happening here. And from what I can tell, what you're seeing is that as these other variants are falling off and can't spread, the only one that's left that can spread is this last one, the Delta or Indian variant. And it is able to survive and take on in this shrinking population here. So Maybe you see a slight uptick where it has more breakthrough instances, but there's just no data that suggests right now that it is causing a surge anywhere. I know people have talked about there being a surge in the United Kingdom, but even there, the numbers aren't overly concerning. It's just a slight uptick. It's not a surge. This thing still struggles, like all the other, to break through a vaccinated population. It does not struggle with an unvaccinated person, but it does struggle in a vaccinated population. So if you're vaccinated, I don't think you have to worry about this thing too much. If you've been vaccinated for a long time, I don't think you have to worry about it at all. But if you're unvaccinated, you should be concerned about it. Or if you've never had COVID-19 and you don't have that natural immunity, if you don't have some kind of immunity from this, from either having it or having a vaccine, you should be concerned about it because, again, it is more deadly and contagious. Current reports are showing that most of the people who are currently hospitalized due to COVID-19 are not vaccinated or don't have natural immunity. You don't have that protection there. So the Indian variant is strong that it can go after some of these younger age cohorts. So it's important, if you haven't had COVID-19, it's important to get that vaccination to have that support from, you know, this variant. There could be others that come down the road. So far, I don't think we're going to need a booster shot from any of the vaccines. I think you just need to have it, and that gives you that base level of protection. And it, so far, it looks like it lasts, so I don't think we're going to need that. I think all the, you know, you may see a booster shot developed, but I don't think we're going to need it at this rate. So again, it's another week of just fantastic news. It's another week showing that vaccines work. It's another week that shows the CDC's freak out over blood clots and other things was really moronic. More people, I mean, people at all, they should be fired for that decision because it was a dumb decision. But otherwise, we're in good shape right now. Regardless, the rates are slow for my taste, but we are still building. We're building that growth towards a full herd immunity. The best modeling that I've seen that tries to answer the question, you know, what is our herd immunity level in the United States? If you factor in both the number of people who are vaccinated along with the people who have had the virus. If you try to model that out, because it's an inexact science, you're talking that potentially around 71% of the total U.S. population is now immune from COVID-19. So that is very high. That obviously varies from state to state. So some of these states have had lower levels of vaccinations and lower levels of infection rates. So they are not quite at that level. But in generally speaking, across the United States, everyone is around 71%. It's like the national rate is right at 71%. In Tennessee, we're at 69% because the vaccination rate is lower, but more people have had it, so that gives you sort of that higher number. So you kind of have to pick and choose different states to see where they are. But in general, I think that 71% number is pretty decent way, just because we know the vaccination rates are around 60%. We know we've had a pretty decent number of people in the United States who have had it. Between 70 and 75% seems like a safe guess there, because you know you got some overlap of people who have had the virus and have also gotten a vaccination, so that's double counting. And you know, it's just a whole mess there. So I think 71%, based on just the drop in numbers that we're seeing, I think this all makes sense, and that's probably about where we are. We're within a certain level of herd immunity right now. I don't think you can doubt that at any level, just because the numbers suggest that we're there. Just on raw vaccination numbers, we're there to some level. It's just a matter of how do you factor in that plus natural immunity that's from COVID-19 itself. So 70, 75%, that's probably a good range for what you need to think about there. Maybe at the low end at 65, I think that's too low, just because I think we're higher than that. 70, 75 is probably a good way to think about it. You want that number to go higher, and you want the number of cases to go down, because you'd rather have people vaccinated as opposed to getting it and having to develop natural immunity, because that just takes a lot longer to get over with. And we don't know if this thing does it too long term, and that it was designed more than likely in a lab to go after humans. I think that's how you have to think about it. I think given the evidence that we have now, I think you have to think of this thing as a lab creation that was designed to go after human lungs. And barring new information that disproves that, I think you need to treat it as that and be protected. So that's where we are. We have good numbers. Things are all positive. I don't really have that many complaints on that front. Besides, I think a full investigation needs to be happened into our overall response, specifically the CDC and FDA, but that's a topic for another day. And that is all I've got for this week. The light item, as I mentioned at the top, is from Bill Maher, who went off at the end of this past week on progressives who can't see that the world is becoming a better place. Now, Bill Maher, of course, is a far left liberal himself. But from this and other videos he's made recently, I think it's kind of funny to watch him beginning to come at odds with his own side of politics. So this is his version, you know, a liberal version of why the woke left is wrong about everything and wrong about a lot of things. And I thought it was pretty funny. So give it a listen here.
And finally, new rule. From now on, when Joe Biden veers off into one of his long-winded stories that seem to be off topic, everyone must realize he usually does have a point.
But those of you who are over 50, how often did you ever see advertisements on television with black and white couples? Not a joke. I challenge you, find today, when you turn on the stations, sit on one station for 2 hours, and I don't know how many commercials you'll see, lay 8 to 5. 2 to 3 out of 5 have mixed race couples in them.
I'm going to tell you, I know it sounds kind of out of left field, but actually Uncle Joe is pointing liberals towards something they need to be more aware of. They have a bad case of progressophobia. That's the phrase coined by Steven Pinker to describe a brain disorder that strikes liberals and makes them incapable of recognizing progress. It's like situational blindness, only what you can't see is that your dorm in 2021 is better than the South before the Civil War. If you think America is more racist now than ever, more sexist than before women could vote, and more homophobic than when blowjobs were a felony, you have progressophobia and should adjust your mask because it's covering your eyes. You know, before 2012, every time gay marriage was put before a state's voters, it lost. 35 times in a row. Now it's the law of the land in every state. Even half of Republicans are for it. The other half are for closeted gay sex. The chant from gay protesters used to be, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." Well, we did. This is Pride Month, and it's not even a big deal anymore. 30 days of parades and festivals celebrating a cause that was once so divisive, Ellen had to pretend to be straight. State houses fly pride flags now. Disney celebrates it. By federal law, every single TV show must include a storyline about lesbians having a baby. If someone announces they're gay on TV, it's met with thunderous applause. My accountant says, "Yas, queen." You literally can't find a major American corporation that doesn't do something for Pride Month. NASCAR does it. Raytheon, maker of high-tech lethal weaponry that kills people from the sky, does it. And I hear next year they're going to paint "You Go Girl" on the side of their missile. And it's not just LGBT issues. Not that long ago, I knew people who went to prison for growing pot. And today you can legally smoke it for fun in 43% of the country, and I will. Even something like bullying, it still happens. But being outwardly cruel to people who are different is no longer acceptable. That's progress. And acknowledging progress isn't saying we're done or we don't need more. And being gloomier doesn't make you a better person. In 1958, only 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage. Now, Gallup doesn't even bother asking. The last time they did in 2013, 87% approved. An overwhelming majority of Americans now say they want to live in a multiracial neighborhood. That is a sea change from when I was a kid. In a country that's 14% black, 18% of the incoming class of Harvard is black, And since 2017, white students are not even a majority in our public colleges. Employees of color make up 47% of Microsoft, 50% of Target, 55% of The Gap, as companies become desperate to look like their TV commercials. The Friends reunion we just had looked weird. Because if you even suggested a show today about six people, all of whom were straight and white, the network would laugh you out of the room and then cancel you on Twitter. And yet there is a recurrent theme on the far left that things have never been worse. Kevin Hart expressed a view many hold when he told the New York Times, "You're witnessing white power and white privilege at an all-time high." This is one of the big problems with wokeness, that what you say doesn't have to make sense or jibe with the facts or ever be challenged, lest the challenge itself be conflated with racism. But saying white power and privilege is at an all-time high is just ridiculous. Higher than a century ago, the year of the Tulsa race massacre? Higher than the years when the KKK rode unchecked and Jim Crow went unchallenged? Higher than the 1960s when the Supremes and Willie Mays still couldn't stay in the same hotel as the white people they were working with? Higher than during slavery? And I mean actual slavery, not Prince doesn't like his record contract slavery. Racism is still, unfortunately, still with us. We have the footage. In policing, housing, job discrimination, segregated schools, wealth inequality, the legacy of injustice sadly lives on and demands remedial action. I understand, as best I can, how racism singes a person's soul so much that they might see it everywhere. But seeing clearly is necessary for actually fixing problems, and clearly, racism is simply no longer everywhere. It's not in my home, and it probably isn't in yours, if I read my audience right, and I think I do. For most of the country, the most unhip thing you could ever be today is a racist. Even Derek Chauvin was not backed up by his fellow officers, and that never used to happen. The low point of race relations wasn't Kim Kardashian wearing cornrows, even though it happened on Snapchat and George Wallace standing in a doorway didn't. Because here's the thing, kids. There actually was a world before you got here. We date human events, AD and BC, but we need a third marker for millennials and Gen Z. BY, before you. It's telling that in a recent Harvard youth poll of Americans between 18 and 29, 72% of blacks said they were hopeful about the future of America, as compared to only 46% of whites. I'm not surprised. There are a hell of a lot of Americans trying really hard these days to embrace a new spirit of inclusion and self-reflection, and this progressive allergy to acknowledging societal advances is self-defeating, because progress and hope that we can achieve it is the product we're selling. And having a warped view of reality leads to policies that are warped. Black-only dorms and graduation ceremonies, a growing belief in whiteness as a malady and white people as irredeemable, giving up on a colorblind society. Only if you believe we've made no progress does any of that make sense. I can name some things that actually are worse than they've ever been before, like the environment and homelessness in LA and the prospects for maintaining an actual democracy in America. But where progress has been made, it's not a sin, and it's certainly not inaccurate to say, we've come a long way, baby. Not mission accomplished, just a long way.
So that's Bill Maher. I thought that was pretty funny. It's a pretty good clip of him. Pretty much speaking the truth on a lot of things there, especially if you do come from that persuasion, I think you have to admit that he's right on all those things. Obviously, I don't agree on everything being positive for his side, but things have changed, and I don't think you can deny a lot of those things. That's all I've got for today's show, though. Questions, comments, corrections, or feedback, you can reach out to me in the contact information in the show notes, or hit me up on Twitter at DevonCI. Look for my next columns on Monday and Friday at the Conservative Institute, and the newsletter goes out early Friday morning, so make sure to sign up before that, and you will get the next issue. Thank you for listening to this podcast and making it a part of your day. Remember, if you liked and enjoyed it, make sure to send those 5-star reviews to help us out. I hope you tune in again, but until then, I'm your host, Daniel Vaughn, signing off for this week, and I will see you guys in the next episode.